Colin O'Mara worked as San Jose, California's clean tech strategist, developing a long-term plan for both economic growth and environmental sustainability. He's put that expertise to use in his current job as Secretary of the Environment and Energy, appointed by Delaware Governor Jack Markell. He's chief steward of Delaware's natural resources and heads up the state's efforts to improve air and water quality, restore wildlife habitat, reduce flood damage, remediate contaminated sites, and expand access to outdoor activities. He joins us on Radio Times to tell us how his background in green technology informs the work he's doing in Delaware and to talk about how the state is recovering from Superstorm Sandy. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good. Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me on today.
Last time we had you on was by telephone at the very beginning of Superstorm Sandy. How did Delaware do?
There was a lot of damage. I mean, there were parts of Delaware that did get hit fairly hard. A lot of inland flooding, for example, down in our resort communities in the southern part of the state. There was some sand loss in some of the communities along the oceanfront. But fortunately, because of the way the storm came through, it really was from the kind of the southwesterly wind on the backside, as opposed to the devastation that you saw to the north of us. But, you know, we have a $150 million bridge that lost most of the sand around the approach. It's fairly vulnerable right now. There are some wildlife refuges and others that had a lot of damage. And then we had several $1 million of damage for homes that are in our coastal communities. But compared to what we could have faced, sure, we were very blessed to come off the way we did.
And compared to your neighbor, New Jersey, certainly.
Oh, no, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we were fortunate. The dunes that we have worked on very, very, just with incredible diligence over the last several years did their job. We did have high tides of, you know, 14, 15, 16 feet. But these dune systems really did protect the millions and billions of dollars of assets on the other side of them during the storm.
But as you said, it was really coming in, I guess, off the Delaware Bay in a kind of a surprise hit from Sandy.
Yeah, I mean, the concern up to that point was that the storm was going to be south of us or even coming directly through us, at which point you have kind of the wind kind of counterclockwise coming out kind of from 3 o'clock to 1 to midnight kind of on the clock, and then hitting, you know, kind of the Delaware Bay as it moved further north. For the most part, we still had a lot of the wave action, the heavy rains, but most of the damage that we saw was actually from flooding from our inland bays, which are these kind of remarkable resources in the southern part of our state, being pushed from west to east on the backside of these communities. So it wasn't a typical storm along a coast.
So what is the plan for recovery for Delaware?
So we've been working really closely with our congressional delegation, led by our senior senator, Tom Carper. We've been working closely with FEMA as well, and most of the conversation is about, you know, how do we need to repair the things that were damaged, and we're doing all that, but really, what are the next round of investments? And, you know, we've had a longstanding, over the last maybe year and a half, 2 years, work of a very public process around sea level rise adaptation. The same assets that are vulnerable long-term with sea level rise are the same assets that are vulnerable short-term with coastal storms. And so looking at these extreme weather events, what are the investments that we need to make? And it's not just repairing our dunes and looking at our beaches, but how do you have, you know, functioning wetlands that can hold that water around neighborhoods and making sure that the water is going to kind of where you want it to and not flooding people out? How do you look at critical infrastructure, whether it's our bridges or roads or our dikes and dams, making sure that we're making those investments now as opposed to, you know, waiting to the next storm? And so we've looked at, you know, I don't know, almost 80 different types of critical infrastructure that are vulnerable in some way. And, you know, we've kind of begun to make investments in a lot of those. And it's not just the places that people would assume. I mean, a lot of folks, when they think about a storm like this, they really think about the beaches, because that's what we saw a lot of in New Jersey. You know, but when you look at some of the damage in places in New York, I mean, it was urban areas. And so even in a small state like Delaware, places like, you know, the city of Wilmington, fairly low lying. You have multiple bodies of water that are kind of going throughout the city. Places like Old Newcastle and other places like Delaware City, even though they're more kind of urbanized compared to the more agriculture and tourism areas of the south, extremely vulnerable. They're at or below sea level in some cases. The only defenses they have may be in a dike that may be 300 years old. And so we're making those investments, and the governor's been really proactive trying to make sure we're doing this ahead of time so we're not reacting the way that some of the other people are.
I spent some of my childhood living in Delaware, so I know it's a very flat state, and some of it, even back in the olden days, you know, under sea level. Do you see evidence then of sea level rise?
Yeah, the gauges do show that there has been an accelerated rate, and the concern isn't kind of the year to year. The concern is like the trend line, and You know, there's been some studies by USGS that say that the Mid-Atlantic is actually more vulnerable than other parts of the country because the rates are just a little accelerated. And there's some reasons for that.
And a lot of people live there, too.
Exactly. And so, I mean, just in the Delaware River Basin, for example, you have 15 million people between New York City and Delaware, and kind of including New Jersey and Philadelphia. The concern that I think a lot of folks have now is really trying to think through, you know, how do we make sure that those folks aren't in harm's way? Because these aren't people that would typically be considered vulnerable. But we, like you said, we're just a very low-lying coastal state.
But, in fact, we did a show a couple of weeks about this. The question about, you know, retreat, the idea is, you know, is to let nature do what nature is going to do, remove people from these vulnerable areas. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. I think it's a tough conversation.
It sure
is. And it's going to take a lot of leadership, and it's going to take kind of hard truths being spoken. One thing that we've tried to do is really kind of frame out the policy choices, because there are some places that it makes sense to, you know, nourish the beaches and, you know, build fortifications and things like that in the short term and some in the long term, and really trying to say, you know, these are the costs and these are who's paying the costs. And that's a tough conversation because a lot of times in these situations, the benefits really are accrued to private individuals where the costs are really spread across all taxpayers. And so, you know, the Wilmington News Journal has actually done a great job kind of covering some of this story, and as WHYYS as well, I'm kind of really covering the economics of these decisions. And, you know, if it costs, you know, $100 million over 20 years to protect something, what's the cost-benefit ratio? And so it's less of an emotional decision, but it's just hard economics. And I think there is a role for the public to play, but maybe it's not 100%.
Especially in tough economic times where government is having to make tough choices about where and how to spend money. I was also reading that to restore or repair a beach, it's about $5 to $8 million a mile. Does that fit your formula?
Yeah, it's about that. I mean, it depends on kind of the scale of nourishment. It really is more of kind of by volume, but it gets really expensive really quickly. And the traditional model is to have the federal government in our ocean beaches pay about 2/3, and the state comes up with 1/3. There is a cost benefit test they have to meet to qualify for that program. In our bay beaches, the communities don't meet that test. It's the value of the nourishment is actually more than the federal government's willing to invest based on the benefit that they've calculated. And so it's all state dollars or local dollars or community dollars. And so it does change the economics.
So are the Bay Beach communities the ones that seem most vulnerable then in Delaware?
They really are, yeah.
And is that just because of just how the geology works and how marshes and things like that are working?
Well, the Marvin Peninsula is fascinating because, I mean, you have some of the best wildlife habitat, and you have these incredible, you know, shorebird populations and things like that, and the horseshoe crabs. But from a geologic point of view, you have subsidence going on. The peninsula is actually sinking a little bit, and not very quickly, but it is. You have a lot of erosion, and so anytime you have tidal action, you kind of have erosion of the beaches and some of the losing sediment out of the wetlands. You do have some inland flooding challenges with just kind of increased volumes of water. And then you have kind of the sea level rise as well. So you put those four factors together, and it's a pretty scary cocktail long term, not over the next 5 or 10 years, but over the next, you know, 50 to 100 years. And so it really is about trying to figure out, you know, what are those short-term investments so we're not putting anyone else in harm's way, and that we're protecting folks that are there, access and egress, and then not overextending our resources, because we really don't want to pass on a massive debt to future generations either, because the money has to come from somewhere.
We were talking about this before the show began about the importance of marshes. Does it make sense to rebuild and rethink the role of marshes?
Well, absolutely. And the challenge is that these, you know, wetlands are a great example. They've always been considered kind of an environmental asset that folks like me that, you know, like our Birkenstocks and our, you know, and like
that,
our
certain, me,
like our surfboards, really want to protect, and that's really not the only value they provide. They do provide incredible wildlife habitat. They provide great fishery nursery. They provide absolutely incredible water quality benefits. But if that's the cheapest way to keep a community from flooding out, we need to talk about that. And it's not just an environmental asset. It's a public health and safety asset that we need to protect and preserve throughout this entire region. It's not just Delaware. I mean, it's really the entire Mid-Atlantic.
Well, talking about water quality, I was reading something in the Cape Gazette about it looks like a meeting you had last week with some of the Inland Bay Citizens Action Committee about things like water quality and storm management, and the fact that there is, and our listeners will excuse me, but things like bacteria and fecal matter and things that have to be remediated one way or the other.
No, absolutely. And I think, and like I said before, I mean, I do think that there's a there's a paradigm shift that has to occur. And I know that sounds cliche, but these things have been considered in a lot of cases kind of environmental niceties. It's like when you have money, you invest in wetlands or open space or things like that. In this new reality that we're facing, kind of this new normal, they're going to become necessities. And it's not just an environmental necessity, but really if you just keep a strong economy to really protect public health and safety. And until as we're making that transition, it really is important that we think about these things differently. I mean, it's not just about the birds and the bunnies and the butterflies. I mean, it really is about protecting communities and protecting lives in many cases.
And about sewer systems, like that. I mean, something as basic as that.
Right. And there, in the case of Hurricane Sandy, we had, in our Inland Bays area, there's a lot of inundation, inches and inches of rain. And then, like I said before, the flooding from the inland. So we saw, fecal matter from different wildlife populations, geese, things like that, all get poured into the waterways. We actually had to close some of our shell fisheries for a few days. We were able to kind of get them back open fairly quickly as the system flushed itself. But these are real concerns, and I mean, there's very little drinking water that comes from these sources. It comes from other sources in that part of the state, but it does have a long term impact, and that's the economic impact of that on our commercial watermen and others is an economic impact as much as it is an environmental concern.
So is it a matter of educating people, regulating people in order to address this issue?
I think it's a little bit of both. I don't think we can regulate our way out of whether it's a water quality challenge or actually dealing with some climate impacts. I mean, I think that has to be part of the solution. You have to have a basic set of kind of rules that make sense. But it really is going to take folks caring about this issue and being neighbor to neighbor, and not just environmental advocates and government officials, but how do we convince folks to care about that waterway in their backyard? Not just because it's beautiful, but really because it provides a huge economic value to the community, and that if we don't protect it, it could flood you out. And so, kind of looking at it a little more holistically.
In a perverse way, I think that Sandy has, I don't know if exactly taught a lot of lessons, but certainly there are so many lessons to be learned from Sandy, whether it has to do with things like sea level rise, but also the fact that we live so close together and we're so dependent on all these systems that are part of our infrastructure.
Absolutely, and I think that there are some lessons to be learned that government alone can't solve a lot of these problems. And I do think that a lot of folks kind of say, well, somebody else is worrying about that. I don't have to worry about water quality because government's doing that. I don't have to worry about flood protection because this local government's doing that. And it really is going to take everyone kind of thinking through how they can be part of the solution as opposed to just assuming that their tax dollars are kind of covering it, because it is much more complicated than just another policy or another piece of legislation. It really is parcel by parcel, block by block, how to become more resilient in the Mid-Atlantic for the next generation.
And the question is whether those lessons will be learned or whether they will be forgotten.
Exactly. And in the last couple of years, and we've had really bad nor'easters in 9 and 10. We had Irene last year, and we had Sandy this year. Obviously, the damage from Sandy was much worse than Irene, but at some point, with so much frequency, I think we do need to think differently about how we prepare and how we build in this region.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Colin O'Mara. He's Secretary of the Environment and Energy for Delaware, appointed by Governor Jack Markell. He's had this job for a couple of years now. We invited him to join us on Radio Times to talk about some of the challenges that he and the state of Delaware are facing, and frankly, we all are facing as we think about things like climate change and sea level rise and the environment and energy. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from our Delaware listeners, but not exclusively. We'd love to hear from everybody at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Dave and Aaron Go to Work. Created and performed by Barrymore Award-winning Philadelphia artists Dave Jotico and Aaron Cromie. Dave and Aaron Go to Work harkens back to the days of Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, and Buster Keaton in a wordless comedy for all ages. Tickets for Dave and Aaron Go to Work are available now at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
Put together Britt Daniel of Spoon and Dan Beckner of Handsome Furs, and the supergroup label rears its ugly head. But Divine Fits doesn't care.
The idea for this band wasn't hatched by some manager sitting in a boardroom. It happened because we were friends, and we have a lot of admiration for each other's music, and how could that be a bad thing?
That's Britt Daniel of Divine Fits. They join us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design offers evening art and design studios for adults at their convenient Center City campus. Programs include fashion design, digital photography, jewelry, and certificate programs for career advancement in print and web design, fashion studies, and interior design. The continuing education winter session at Moore College of Art and Design begins Tuesday, January 22nd. Further details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Colin O'Mara, Secretary of the Environment and Energy for the state of Delaware. As we know, Delaware was not hit as hard by Sandy as New Jersey was, but there was still some damage that the state is dealing with. This storm did raise awareness concerns about the things like the threat of sea rise and future superstorms that will inevitably work their way up the coast. We invited Colin O'Mara to join us on Radio Times to tell us what Delaware is doing and to take calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. A couple years ago, I was biking outside of Amsterdam, you know, a beautiful bike trail, noticing that just sort of how the sea level rise has been managed in places like the Netherlands. It's important, I guess, to learn what other countries are doing to deal with this real issue.
No, many of the solutions that we're going to need to adopt over the next generation really, I mean, have been tried in many parts of the world. And whether it's, you know, whether it's climate impact or just traditional flooding or, you know, just intense storms or heavy seas, I think there are lessons to learn all over the place. And some of them are engineered, some of them are more natural, some of them are, you know, kind of fortification, and some of them are more like retreat. And so I think there are none of the solutions that we're really going to need to adapt on the adaptation side over the next generation are really foreign. It's just a matter of prioritizing and figuring out which ones make sense, kind of community by community.
Right. What works where.
Exactly.
But it's interesting that there are at least some technological fixes worth thinking about.
Absolutely. And some of the best technological fixes are actually on the adaptation side. Yep. Are really just letting Mother Nature's, you know, kind of incredible resources help protect us. I mean, if you look at places that got flooded out, in many communities, there are places that, you know, built on functioning wetlands that, you know, could have provided that flood relief. There are places that, you know, dunes have had eroded to the point where they really couldn't serve that protective value. And so it really is trying to make sure that as we're building, it's not about stopping development and kind of completely. It's just really more about building in a smarter way that's more resilient. And so we're thinking about the, you know, that 100-year storm that may be coming every year or every other year in some cases. And we're not just trying to react after the fact.
I wonder, too, whether the insurance companies will have a greater impact on regulation and development, even more than states and private enterprise.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And there's kind of two pieces. There's kind of the more public insurance programs that, you know, like the National Flood Insurance Program and things like that. And I think they're beginning to look at some of these impacts. I mean, there's been a big push from folks to make sure that these kind of considerations are built into it so you're not kind of paying out for things that, you know, kind of are predictable. At the same time, on the private side, there are entire parts of the Mid-Atlantic region right now that you can't get typical private insurance. You know, you might have to go to like a Lords of London or something like that to try to get insurance at a very high premium, if at all. And a lot of them, you know, maybe they don't include kind of catastrophic events or, you know, massive flooding or hurricanes and things like that. So the markets are beginning to adjust, even if our politics aren't catching up nearly as quickly.
How did you get into this line of work?
I grew up in a remarkable part of the country. I grew up in upstate New York, which is just a beautiful place. You know, Great Lakes and just absolutely a beautiful part of the country. And I think at the same time I saw that a lot of the environmental assets had been degraded over time. One of the dirtier lakes in the country is in that part. And so, you know, as folks were kind of chasing, you know, kind of the next job, a lot of the amenities they really needed to have a functioning economy were degraded. And they're doing incredible work to restore these things. But I think that lesson kind of growing up combined with some work I did in graduate school where I got into the economics. Because a lot of times you have, you know, and a lot, over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, there's been a lot of debate kind of government, kind of business versus the environment, as opposed to having folks kind of speak a more common language around the economics of the environment. And as you're seeing in, you know, folks in, you know, the Naval Yard and others right here and all across Delaware, there's a lot of good profitable businesses to be created, cleaning up things, you know, creating cleaner energy efficiency, things like that. And so all of a sudden it kind of clicked for me saying, well, what if we kind of promoted kind of a healthier environment? And at the same time, use that as a mechanism to build a stronger economy. And so it's that kind of that little light bulb that went off, you know, a decade ago that really shaped a lot of what I did in San Jose and then definitely what I've done in Delaware.
And what did you do in San Jose?
Well, in San Jose, obviously the epicenter of Silicon Valley, a remarkable community, just a hotbed of innovation and, you know, as many, you know, patents coming out of that region as anywhere in the world. But One of the things that was interesting is they hadn't fully transitioned away from kind of the dot-com bust or boom and then kind of subsequent bust, and trying to figure out kind of what's the next wave of innovation that makes sense to kind of build the just maintain the high quality of life and the number of jobs that they have in that region. And so into kind of 2005, 2006, 2007, they were really on the leading edge of clean technology and kind of clean energy solutions, energy efficiency, advanced transportation, green building, into renewable energy. And so I was working with the mayor, Chuck Reed, who's just a remarkably visionary guy. And he had the idea of saying, well, what if we try to tie these together? What if we said, look, our environmental strategy is going to be our economic development strategy. They're going to be one and the same. They're not going to be two separate parts of the organization. We're going to tie them together. And I was just fortunate he let me kind of help play a role in that. And it really did show pretty quickly that when a government was willing to send that signal, entrepreneurs were willing to invest. A lot of these good ideas were kind of really close to commercialization. And so with just a little bit of help from government, kind of clearing some red tape and just making it easy to grow, there were thousands of jobs that were created in these areas over a couple of years.
And what kind of jobs are we talking about?
Well, these are really well-paying jobs, and a lot of times they're engineering jobs. There's a big push in Silicon Valley around solar, renewable energy. A lot of next-generation technologies that really are just really exciting and have the chance to make it a much more cost-competitive technology than maybe it always is. Even though that price curve has come down a lot since I was in San Jose, a lot of technology around advanced transportation, electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, really looking at ways to kind of reduce the footprint of the transportation sector a lot with biofuels and all kinds of, whether it be synthetics or kind of full-blown things like LG or kind of the next generation biofuels, a lot around wind, fuel cells, and really just kind of looking at what are all the kind of disruptive technologies that can kind of replace or at least complement kind of the existing system as we're trying to have this transition towards a kind of a cleaner future.
Why do you think solar hasn't made the kind of progress I think that its supporters had hoped that it would?
I think that it still is a somewhat more expensive technology, and so for the last few years it has been fairly subsidy dependent, and the subsidies have been inconsistent at the federal level. They're really different state to state, and so Delaware actually has tens of megawatts installed, I think more than 30 megawatts right now. And so we've kind of become a leader per capita in installation. But I think one of the reasons it's been a lot of buy-in is that the majority of the panels that are being installed in Delaware are actually fabricated in Delaware. And so there's a little plant in Newark, Delaware, by the university that's actually assembling and kind of putting together the modules. And so there's a direct link with the job side of it. I think there is some hesitancy in some parts of the country where a lot of the panels are maybe coming from China or other parts of the world. And that's really the main challenge, which is how do you seize both the economic development opportunities from good manufacturing jobs that could be anywhere in the world, but if you have a good market, they tend to be close because transport costs and things like that are expensive. And I think if you have that, it's easier to then have a little bit of a subsidy. But over the last couple of years, that price curve has really come down precipitously. But I think it's got to be easy for folks to make the change. I think you can't have a long-term subsidy. But I think we're getting there. It's just hard because a lot of the policy is at the federal level, and there's just been so much animosity around these questions the last few years. It's hard to kind of make long-term investments in this field without knowing where Congress is going to be.
I'd love some kind of nano solar technology instead of gigantic panels on buildings that you could have just a circle that would be that hub of all that solar energy.
Well, it is amazing, the technologies, though. There's a lot of concentrated solar technologies in San Jose that we saw. There was also some great things like rolled roofing that was solar panels. These thin film technologies that weren't the big bulky kind of 3x5 panels that you typically see, but really just so you'd be basically insulating layer on top of your roof that would also serve as kind of the last layer, and you'd roll it out. It'd be a little less efficient, but it'd be a lot less costly, so the trade-off was pretty good. So the technologies are there. We just need to make sure there's a market to use them.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you again, and that's Colin O'Mara. He's Secretary of the Environment and Energy for the state of Delaware, appointed by Delaware Governor Jack Markell a couple of years ago. And joining us on Radio Times, I am picking his brain about a whole host of environmental and technological issues. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, covering a lot of territory in this hour of Radio Times. Let me see what Howard from Kensington has to say. And Howard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm calling from the Philadelphia area, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was saying that my partner is from the southern states, and they were taught how to deal with tornadoes and hurricanes. And because of the fact that we don't really have that in Philadelphia, we haven't had an issue so far, how can we get assistance to learn how to, deal with tornadoes and hurricanes, safeguard our homes and our families, through the community, I guess, through, not necessarily through the government, but through an agency or something that can help us, because if something happened, I really think that it would be a tragedy in this area.
Indeed. Howard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Thoughts, Colin?
No, it's a great question. Thank you, Howard. And I think Mayor Nutter has actually done a pretty remarkable job in the last couple of years. I mean, the GreenWorks program he's doing on stormwater and some other things.
Yeah,
I think
the water department's gotten some high marks.
They've done a remarkable job, and you know, Lisa Jackson was here recently kind of praising them for some work. And so I think on the government preparedness side, I think they're doing a good job, but you're exactly right. And how do we get, you know, kind of, you know, folks just kind of the information they need to make kind of good decisions for themselves and their family. And so there's a lot of regional conversations going on right now, you know, between the governors, between the mayors. But really, it's got to be easy. And, you know, it's got to be, it's more than just saying, hey, you know, make sure you have your, you know, your kind of key food items, your items to get through the couple days. But there are a lot of places. You know, if you go to like ready.gov, which is a website, ready.gov is a website. There's also state sites in a lot of places that kind of lay it out. But I think we need to kind of move beyond, you know, just kind of talking through websites or services, but really get into communities and work with, you know, churches, work with neighborhood groups, and really talk about, you know, places that are vulnerable. And that's what we're trying to do in Delaware. I know that's what they're trying to do in Philly. But if there's ideas that you or others have, you know, please let your local officials know, because I think that folks want to get the word out proactively, so then you're not scrambling trying to hope that folks have power to actually see or hear a press conference to try and get the information, which is always a challenge in the middle of the story.
Howard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We want to hear from everybody, but of course, if you're calling from Delaware, we will move you to the top of the list. What's so interesting, you know, the most boring in the world in the word in the world a couple of years ago was infrastructure. I mean, nobody wanted to talk about it besides, you know, then Governor Rendell, then Governor Schwarzenegger, and current Governor Bloomberg of New York. But now it's all about infrastructure.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I still remember when those three, you know, when they kind of went nationally, and they should propose it. And I was with Governor Rendell maybe a year and a half ago, talking about this over at a dinner. And, you know, he kind of laid out, this is how you pay for it, and this is why it's important. And it was interesting because at the time, a lot of the conversation was, you know, well, we saw what happened in Minnesota with a bridge, or we saw what happened, you know, with, you know, in the Bay Area with with earthquakes. I think this is almost another layer of kind of the importance of it. And I think it is going to be more real for folks than maybe it was. I think it's always an important conversation. We have trillions of dollars of deferred maintenance on our critical infrastructure. And if we're building those things in a way that actually solves this question also, we'll be in a much better shape. But, you know, Governor Rendell was well ahead of the curve talking about these things, hoping to get some things done in the second term.
You had mentioned some of the new technologies, and I think battery technology is fascinating. It feels as if it hasn't, again, quite gotten to the place where it could or probably should be. But what future do you see in battery technology?
I do think there's a big future. There's kind of two pieces to it. One's on the vehicle side, one's on the storage side for the electrical grid. And I think on the battery side, on the vehicle side, I think there has been a lot of advances. Unfortunately, some of the companies that are kind of the most innovative have really struggled the last few years.
Including Fisker, right, in Delaware.
Yeah, and there's a company called A123 that has an incredible technology that's had some challenges having a sufficient order book to make the capital investments they need to then, you know, kind of grow. And so they're going through some proceedings right now. It's more of a chemistry problem than it is a physics problem. And a lot of folks kind of compare it to, you know, a computer chip. And it's really kind of a different issue. But I do think that kind of predictability is going to be if there's predictable market, you'll see additional investment in this area. One of the most innovative technologies I'm really excited about is something coming out of the University of Delaware, which would actually allow for an electric vehicle to actually serve as kind of a two-way device. And so it would actually, so you would charge the car if you needed to use it, but you could also use the battery in the car as a storage device to help the grid. And so if the grid needed additional power, you could put power back on the grid from the battery. And then get compensated for that the same way if you had a little power plant. But then it would actually help stabilize the grid. And so it could help with, like, having, you know, more intermittent sources of resources, or help during, you know, peak prices and peak demand times. But so really innovative technologies that are possible. It's just, you know, it's hard to have entrepreneurs making those investments if they're not confident the market's going to be there.
Well, and I guess then it raises questions about the role of the government. Right. The role of the private sector to support this kind of innovation.
Right. No, exactly. And I think we've seen this play out, you know, in a fairly contentious way the last couple of years. I mean, I always feel that, you know, it's the role of government to kind of help kind of identify where we should be heading. Not in a technology specific way, but just saying, you know, we're trying to achieve these types of performance standards. And we're trying, whether it's around clean air or fuel economy or things around climate. and then let the entrepreneurs invest. And if they have that kind of predictability thing, you know, there is going to be a market for some technology. And the government doesn't pick winners and losers, but says, you know, we're going to, you know, kind of make sure the market is stable. You'll see incredible innovation. I mean, the innovation of this country over the last 100 years built the modern world, and we could do the same thing again if we just have, you know, a little less politics and a little more predictability.
I know another program that you're working with in Delaware has to do with school children and connecting young people to their environment.
No, it's a huge opportunity because I think a lot of kids, particularly elementary and middle school kids, they get it. They understand. I mean, when you talk to them about
scientists, aren't
they?
Yeah,
and the school curriculums around science are getting better and better in every one of these states regionally. You know, they want to recycle. I mean, they're ones telling their parents to, you know, turn off the light and this and that. I think one of the big challenges that I've been focused on though is that a lot of those actions that we consider kind of sustainable, you know, kind of using energy wisely or, you know, having clean energy, things like that, isn't connected to actually going outside and playing. There are some remarkable studies in Delaware that the average kid is spending about 50 hours a week in front of some kind of screen. And that's outside of the classroom. And so that's, you know, a iPhone or a Wii or an Xbox or a PlayStation or, you know, a computer or a TV. I mean, 50 hours a week, I mean, that's a full-time job.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you go back maybe two generations, you know, before Atari, before Nintendo, before America Online, before, you know, kind of all the technological advances, you know, we were playing outside. And it's just, and so there's it's interesting. So you have folks that are kind of more environmentally conscious on the kind of the policy side and on the kind of on the sustainability side, but less environmentally connected to nature. And so we're trying to bridge that gap by getting, you know, more nature into the classroom, more kids into our parks. But the consequences of that dichotomy are terrifying in some ways. I mean, 39% of Delaware kids are obese right now. The number is expected to go up to 60% within 20 years unless we change. 60%
of
Delaware
kids.
Yeah, and that's from, I think it's 5-year-olds to like 15-year-olds, something like that. But then you look at the implications of those statistics, and, you know, whether it's type 2 diabetes or other types of you know, childhood illnesses, their productivity both in school and then eventually in the workforce. And so, you know, trying to get a kid outside, I mean, it sounds like, you know, it's kind of nice, fluffy kind of things we should be doing, but the economic consequences of not kind of changing this curve are really scary. And the sedentary lifestyle that's being encouraged in some ways by parents who are really of the first generation that didn't play outside as much. I mean, they didn't go, you know, fishing with their father because they were playing in the basement. They're playing, you know, Nintendo. Trying to break that chain is going to be an absolutely critical issue for the next, you know, decade.
And in Delaware, when you tell kids or invite kids to go, you shouldn't tell them, but invite the kids to go outside, where do they go?
Well, so, I mean, you want to have safe parks, right? And you have two issues there, right? You want parks that are close to home that folks can ride their bike to. But at the same time, parents need to feel like it's safe. And, you know, when you're hearing about, you know, the latest, you know, abduction or whatever the case may be, you're more hesitant to have your kid outside. So it's safer to have them playing in the basement, you know, with some kind of electronic device than it is to play where, you know, we would be in the forest or the stream or, you know, playing sports or whatever the case may be. So, you know, we need both the destinations in Delaware, some of the best state parks in the entire country. I mean, I've been all over the country, and I love Delaware's parks. But we also need places that are just, you know, two blocks away that folks can just go and when they don't have time to get in the car, but they really can just walk to. And so we're working on both those right now.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Colin O'Mara. He's Secretary of the Environment and Energy for the state of Delaware, appointed a couple of years ago by Delaware Governor Jack Markell. And we're talking about his work in Delaware to connect people with their natural environment, also to deal with some of the challenges that the environment poses, the development poses, that technology offers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the music of Tchaikovsky. John Andrea Nozada conducts Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony, and Alyssa Weilerstein will be heard in Elgar's Cello Concerto. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. December 13th, 14th, and 15th at the Kimmel Center, Alyssa Weilerstein and Tchaikovsky's Third with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Once we went from middle age to old age. Now it's common to get an extra 10 to 20 years. This rather new stage of development means new territory regarding sex, money, self-esteem, and friendships. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, looking at who we are and what we need in the autumn years of our lives. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
CHF, the Chemical Heritage Foundation, supports WHYY. This first Friday, December 7th, CHF celebrates the holiday season with Ryan Burley of Shane Confectionery and the Franklin Fountain, who will share the history and science of candy making. Visitors can watch Burley's classic clear toy candy making process from start to finish, and samples will be available. More information online at chemheritage.org/firstfridays.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Colin O'Mara, again, Secretary of the Environment and Energy for the state of Delaware, Chief Steward of Delaware's Natural Resources, heads up the state's efforts to improve air and water quality, restore wildlife habitat, reduce flood damage, remediate contaminated sites, and expand access to outdoor activities. And we have a full bank of calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what Karen from Kutztown has to say. Karen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi, I'm there. Calling because, and hi, Marty.
Hi there.
You know, when we build new houses, it uses open and agricultural land, of course, and, you know, causes flooding, erosion, et cetera. And yet the federal government always uses housing starts as an economic indicator. You know, we always hear housing starts are up, housing starts are down. And especially since population growth is down, is it necessary to use housing starts as an economic indicator? Could we have some kind of other focus for economic growth, you know, like even alternative energy development?
That's a big question. Let me see what Colin O'Mara said. That's okay, Karen. We take questions big and small. Go ahead,
thanks.
Colin. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think, I mean, there's a great speech by, you know, Bobby Kennedy, you know, in the 1968 campaign when he kind of talked about, you know, kind of what are the right indicators if we're looking at a healthy GDP and, you know, kind of walk through some of the things that you're leaning towards. I mean, we're more interested in kind of that smart infill development that's going to, you know, kind of rebuild our cities and, you know, really make sure that we're, you know, not encouraging sprawl in any way and kind of looking at the economics to try to make it more really make it more profitable to kind of build close to existing infrastructure rather than on that farm field or the forest that you mentioned. And the interesting thing that, you know, we're seeing more and more of is that, you know, kind of the younger generations don't want to have that, you know, 45-minute commute in a car, you know, if they can live close to a city and have some, you know, transit or be able to walk to work. And so I agree with the kind of the premise mm-hmm. that, you know, really should be kind of construction value, but then having some value added for folks that are building in ways that actually kind of strengthen our cities and kind of breathe life into our urban areas and also are more protective because they already have good infrastructure. They're not kind of extending our resources out further to areas that maybe we can't provide, you know, good services in the case of an emergency.
Karen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I can't quote that Bobby Kennedy speech, but I heard it recently, and it was truly inspiring.
Always.
Yes, always. Let's see what David from Horsham has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello?
Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, fine. I wanted to mention that 40 years ago, we were building solar furnaces for the house. And we built over 600 just in Colorado and then came east to the Delaware Valley and started building them here. And it also replaced air conditioning. And these were aftermarket. We could add it to the existing house as long as it was a forced hard air heating. And I was just wondering if he's been doing any research more on solar power for the home.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We touched on this earlier, but go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of solar thermal technologies, whether it's for heating and cooling or it's for kind of heating up water. I mean, we're as a nation, we have done a lot on the solar electricity side. But I take your point. It sounds like you were on the forefront of this, you know, 30, 40 years ago when it was taking off. You know, if you go to, you know, parts of China right now or parts of Israel right now, you know, you'll see, you know, either, you know, you'll see, you know, solar hot water, things like that on pretty much every roof, and, you know, whether it's integrated for different types of uses, but it's a great way to displace energy from the grid in a much more cost-effective way, and it is one of the quickest paybacks. So it just sounds like you were well ahead of the curve, but it's something that I think we need to learn from some of our friends abroad.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. What about efforts to reclaim brown fields in Delaware? What are you doing on that front?
Yeah, we have one of the best brownfield programs in the entire country, and what we really try to do is make it as easy as possible to clean up a contaminated site. I mean, with our history of industrial development and things like that, there are a lot of contaminated sites, chemical plants, things like that. And we have a program. We actually provide a financial incentive to clean up a site, and maybe up to like $250,000 in some cases. And then the same, we expedite the soil sampling, the site remediation plans, and then eventually the cleanup. And we've revitalized our riverfront completely through this program. We've revitalized other parts of Newcastle County, and there's a bunch of projects going on in the city of Wilmington right now. But it is one of the best ways to really bring back a city, because rather than having that blighted eyesore, you already have existing infrastructure. You're already close to that school. You're already close to that water line. You're already close to the sewer line. And so it can be cheaper for folks to kind of build there, and you create more sense of place. And we just feel like we need to make it as easy as possible. But I'm extremely bullish on brownfield development. It also tends to be areas that are less vulnerable in a lot of cases.
Meaning
that they, because they already have existing infrastructure, it's easier to help a community like that adapt to kind of the coming challenges than it is a place that maybe in a greenfield, maybe a little lower lying. And so it's been a huge focus for Governor Markell. And we've seen massive investment in these things, even during the down economy, because folks really want to build places where it's easy and quick. And if we can offer an easier and quicker path there, they'll do it.
Are you a fan of urban farming?
I am.
Which always has felt like an oxymoron, but it's happening in Philadelphia and other cities as well.
Yeah, we have a great Secretary of Agriculture in Delaware, a guy named Ed Key, who has really kind of embraced this idea, trying to make sure that there are those opportunities in cities. And so in the city of Wilmington, there's some great work going on our West End and some other places. And it's not going to, our agriculture industry really is, the southern part of our state. We're, have more chickens per county in Sussex County than any other county in the entire country. And that's really where, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. But if there's a way to have some additional food go to market, more produce in neighborhoods, a little healthier opportunities, and also some additional economic opportunities, it's a great win-win. And so we have some good pilot projects so far that we're excited about.
Let me see what looks like. Matt from Townsend, Delaware, joins us on Radio Times. And Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Whoa.
That's not a good phone line. No, that's not going to work, unfortunately. But I can see what he wants to ask you about. It was something I was reading about as well. And Matt, if you want to call us back, that would be great. But that's, unfortunately, a very bad phone line. He has some questions about Prime Hook Beach in Delaware. We were talking about this before the show began. Help us understand what is happening there and the effect of Sandy on, and I guess other storms in this part of Delaware.
Yeah, the Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge is a remarkable remarkable habitat for both waterfowl as well as shorebirds. And it was acquired by the federal government during the Kennedy administration. And over the first 30 years of the site's existence, there were a lot of kind of saltwater marshes that were kind of converted to freshwater as a way to have additional bird diversity and for waterfowl hunting and bird watching. Over the last few years, the dunes that really did kind of protect the site and the marsh that was behind it has been degraded significantly. The dunes were breached multiple times, but really pretty severely in 2008, again in 2009, and then kind of it's gotten wider and wider and worse and worse from big storms. And the problem is that when they get widened by a storm, the tidal action then just takes more and more sand out every single time. And in this case, the marsh behind it, you start losing the sediment from it as well. So when the tide comes in, you get a lot of water, and when the tide goes out, it takes the water and the sediment with it. And so in some ways, we almost have it's almost like a sound at this point, if you will. That we really need to restore. And so, from our point of view, the first step is really kind of closing the breaches so you don't have additional water coming in. But that really is only a short-term solution. Long-term, you're going to have to restore the marsh. It's not going to be cheap. It does provide kind of world-class habitat. There are local residents that live there that have a road that isn't accessible anytime there's high tide or any kind of strong wind. There's a single road that actually right now is basically almost over open water because the marsh has been degraded so much. Mm-hmm. And so, we're working very close with the Fish and Wildlife Service, but we do think that we need to restore the system. And long term, we think it makes sense economically because of this incredible habitat and that the marsh, a healthy marsh and a healthy dune system can actually protect not just that neighborhood, but also further inland. There's farms, there's other communities that are kind of further in Delaware. But it really is going to take a massive effort. It's not something that the Mid-Atlantic have had to face. These are the types of projects you see in like places like the Everglades or in the Mississippi Delta or you know, even further up the Mississippi River or in the Colorado. And so it's a different kind of skill set that we're involved in. But this is kind of the new reality.
But is it starting with a dune in order to protect the marsh and then building the marsh from there?
Exactly. So you try and get enough sand to kind of plug the breach. And the breach got a lot wider during Sandy. But it starts there, and then you fill the marsh behind it.
I'm also curious, and we've certainly heard a lot about the Chesapeake Bay, the kind of runoff that goes into the Chesapeake Bay from, frankly, from agriculture. Is that true with Delaware Bay as well?
Yeah, in the Chesapeake side, as much as 70% of the runoff in Delaware's portion of the Chesapeake Bay can come from agriculture. And our farmers have done a remarkable job reducing the amount of nutrients going in. I mean, they've actually more farmers kind of per farm in Delaware have nutrient management plans than anywhere else in any other state in the country. We do have similar challenges in the Delaware Bay. It is a little different because a lot of the kind of immediately adjacent areas do have additional wetlands and additional kind of forested areas that do absorb more nutrients than we see kind of in the Chesapeake Bay, where a lot of times the farm might be directly adjacent to the tributary. Mm-hmm. But it is a challenge everywhere. But it's not just the nutrients coming from farms. It's really, you know, stormwater runoff from development, from golf courses, from, you know, heavy fertilizer for, you know, aesthetic purposes. It really is it's a big challenge regionally.
Let me try Matt from Townsend to join us once again. Matt, let's see if we've got a better phone line for you. Thanks for calling back.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, is the state of Delaware through DENREC, one, are you considering buying the beach and making Prime Hook a public beach and all the millions that are going to be spent in taxpayer dollars? And when you restore the marsh, are you restoring it as a saltwater marsh or are you restoring it as a freshwater?
And Matt, do you live sort of down there in that part of Delaware?
I'm a member of the Delaware Audubon Society,
okay.
The board. We've been working on this for quite some time, and the state is going to spend a tremendous amount of money in this low-lying area, and the people really need to be bought out and moved. Like you said, Secretary said, this is an unintendable situation. This isn't going to help by putting a big berm up. It's going to be millions of dollars of taxpayer money to do this.
Well, Matt, I appreciate the fact you called back. Go ahead, Colin.
We do think that that it is absolutely critical that there be additional public access, that if you're going to have a big public investment, that you have to have that kind of benefit. I think at this point, you know, our priority is trying to, you know, fill the breach and then restore the marsh. The kind of the northernmost marsh, if you're kind of familiar with the site, really can't be restored back to freshwater. It's too brackish right now and in the kind of the open water system. And so having additional spartina and others that would kind of stabilize the system as you build more sediment makes the most sense. There is some hope maybe for the kind of the middle impoundment to be freshwater eventually, with some of the kind of the local tributaries kind of feeding into it. And so that way you'd still have the diversity of waterfowl. But as a birder myself, I mean, I would like to see, you know, as much diversity of habitat as possible. And that also simultaneously helps with some of the infrastructure challenges. It's great. We're not at the point yet where, you know, folks are proposing a buyout of the local residents. I mean, we want to see if there are some opportunities to stabilize the system before that. That would be very, very expensive and significantly, probably likely significantly more than actually fixing the system. And it'd be an additional cost. We still would want to restore much of the habitat and the refuge itself. But I take your points completely, and this is it's a huge policy conversation. And if you have ideas, please reach out to my office and let us know.
Matt, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Jerome from Willingboro, New Jersey has to say. Jerome, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I just started interning in the renewable energy industry, and I wanted to know what your thoughts was of the possible impact of trash-to-fuel technology and the impact that could have on the local economy.
Are you a supporter of that, Jerome?
I've researched on that. I actually work in the solar hydrogen. I work with Mike Stritzky.
Okay.
He has a solar hydrogen home in New Jersey. But I'm always looking at other technologies, right. And that's one that seems to have a lot of promise, you know, because you're doing two things at once. You're turning trash into fuel and, you know, clean up the environment at the same time.
Fair enough. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Colin.
I do think that there are some challenges, and I think a lot of the work that was done in this area, you know, 15, 20 years ago was not done particularly well. There weren't good pollution control technologies on the back end, and so I think a lot of folks have concerns about, you know, kind of where these types of facilities are sited. There are other parts of the country that have done, other parts of the world really, that have kind of embraced this technology, required really high standards for air quality, making sure that you have, you know, state-of-the-art pollution controls. If you do that, there is a way to do it fairly safely. It is a little bit more expensive, and so it really is a matter of having a very kind of frank conversation early when the technology or the project's being proposed. Say, look, you know, we're we're willing to kind of entertain the idea. However, you're going to have to meet these kind of air quality standards and making sure you don't have any adverse environmental impact. And so I think it can be done well. It hasn't been done well that many times in the country. There are some pilot projects that we're kind of following, but there haven't been any in Delaware yet.
Jerome, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So what's on the list for the year 2013? What's on your to-do list?
I mean, I think we were fortunate. Governor Markell has done a remarkable job in his first term, and he was just reelected overwhelmingly by the residents of Delaware. And there's some just big, you know, some big fiscal questions. You know, what is the impact of the fiscal cliff conversations have on in Delaware and have on the states, and how do they decide to kind of where they're going to cut and who does it affect?
The fact that Governor Markell is going to be
Both the president and with the speaker. He's the head of the National Governors Association right now, and so he's leading a delegation to meet with the principals. And so I think that obviously will shape kind of where we're headed. One of the things that, you know, we've been talking a lot about in the state is how do we invest in our tourism assets in a way and start talking about them as tourism assets, because there are, you know, there was a study by the University of Delaware that said that there's 59,000 jobs in Delaware, a state of less than a million people, 59,000 jobs in tourism, and, you know, about $6 billion of economic activity. And that's really based on our kind of our four B's, if you will, our beaches, our boaters, our birds, and our bikes. And so, you know, it's our trails, it's our hunters, it's our birders, it's our anglers, it's our commercial and recreational watermen. And so how do we invest in those in a way that makes a lot of sense? I mean, we're also looking at some opportunities to really kind of make water quality a bigger focus. Mm-hmm. In Delaware, I mean, a lot of our local communities really have a lot of energy right now about restoring waterfronts, like riverfront development. I mean, we've seen like the big cities, like the Philadelphias and Wilmingtons. The smaller places are now starting to catch on that really is an economic asset and not just, you know, another source of cost. And so I think there are some big ideas. As you mentioned before, the Children in Nature effort is going to be big over the next year, trying to get more kids outside. We're still doing a lot around air quality, really trying to make sure that Delaware does everything it can inside of its own state borders to clean up its air, because right now about 95% of our pollution is coming from upwind states that's being blown into our state. But a full plate, like always, coming from the state of Delaware.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you came up to Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Marty, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, Colin O'Mara has been our guest, and he's the Secretary of the Environment and Energy for the state of Delaware, appointed a couple of years ago by Delaware Governor Jack Markell. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, including our Facebook page and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back. Coming up next, how to fix a costly and ineffective